the point that we want to be at is that no one like questions or like challenges you about your own identity, because it doesn't make any sense for someone to be like, oh, I know better than you about who you are, right? That is, in a sentence, like the colonial problem.
Welcome to Doing It with me, Hannah Witten, where we talk all things sex, relationships, dating, and our bodies. Hi, welcome back to Doing It. In the UK, it is currently LGBT History Month, and normally I'm really bad at remembering to time relevant episodes around awareness days, weeks, months, and this is no different. I just got lucky this time that this episode, we happen to talk about some of the history of queerness and colonization. There is so much LGBTQ plus history in the UK and in the rest of the world. Definitely go and check out LGBT plus, spelt PLUS, historymonth.co.uk, LGBT plus historymonth.co.uk, where you can find a calendar of all sorts of online events happening that you can get involved in, from workshops, virtual working from home for the LGBTQ plus community, talks, Q&As, and film screenings. And of course, lots of other organizations are doing all sorts of things for LGBT History Month, so get involved. Also, if you haven't watched It's a Sin on Channel 4 yet, I would highly recommend. But you may need to pace yourself because it is a lot. It is beautiful and heartbreaking. It's about the AIDS pandemic in the 1980s, and I won't ramble on about it now, but it is brilliant. Definitely go and check it out if you haven't already. So my guest this week is the wonderful Gayathri Kamalakanthan. They are a decolonizing sex educator with the School of Sex Ed and Decolonizing Contraception, and founder of Inclusive Tamil Arts, and just an all-round brilliant human being. We talk about looking at the history of what we're teaching as sex educators, which allows for an intersectional approach, asking questions like, how do we know what we know when it comes to health, medicine, and contraception, and at whose expense did we gain that knowledge? Gayathri talks about what it means to decolonize queerness and queerness in Tamil history. We chat about maybe my favorite topic at the moment, and that's centering joy in our work as sex educators. How important things like play, imagination, art, and creativity are in an educational setting, but also in sexuality, and how we often lose that joyful, playful part of ourselves as we become adults, but we need to hold on to it for many reasons, but also because of its role in sexuality and our sexual experiences. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Happy LGBT History Month. And as usual, you can find more info and links to everything that we talk about in this episode in the show notes over at doingitpodcast.co.uk. And also, we now have transcriptions. So going forward, new episodes will have transcriptions, and we will be slowly making our way through our backlog of episodes and also adding transcriptions to those, and you can find them on our website. Please let us know what you think over on our Twitter or Instagram at Doing It Podcast. If you like this podcast, please give us a rating and review over on iTunes. It is really appreciated. And here is the brilliant Gayathri Kamalakanthan. Hi, Gayathri. I'm so excited to have this chat with you. How are you doing?
Hi, yeah, I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
Not bad. We had a power cut this morning and I was so nervous that I wasn't going to be able to speak with you and have to be like, I'm sorry. But we're here. The power is back, which is good news.
Good.
Yeah. So I just wanted to kick off really asking, how did you get interested in sex ed and how did you get started with what you do? What's your origin story?
Yeah. So I've always been interested in talking openly about things that I guess in our society are taboo, that we all are sort of curious about. So I remember when I was 10 and I started my period, and we had this big like sari party, as is custom in sort of Tamil households.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, they're called Samathivoda or age attainment ceremonies. And, you know, there was a big sort of celebration in a way, which is nice because it brings the community together. But I wasn't informed at this point from school or from the community about, like, why I was bleeding, you know, what's that about, how to manage pain. It sort of felt abnormal. Because I was the only person my age, in my own mind, right?
Because also that is quite young, so you would have been one of the first as well.
Yeah, and possibly. So, I think from that time, I have had all these questions, and then sort of in secondary school, talking about masturbation with friends, and again feeling like, oh, I was the person that invented it, you know, in your own head as a kid, and you're like, I discovered this thing, no one else knows about it, I must tell people.
I love that.
And then kind of growing up, and then at university, I felt really quite confident just talking about like what it is that I wanted in terms of pleasure, what I didn't want. And actually it's interesting when you say origin story, I don't know where precisely that confidence came from. Like maybe I went to an all-girls school, and I often like to say that, you know, like what I didn't learn within like the kind of structured classroom or from my family where sex was very much a taboo, I learned from the girls. We like raised each other. Do you know what I mean?
You learn it on the playground.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, I think that has had a really big sort of role to play in why I didn't feel embarrassed, you know, being quite vocal and directive about like what physical or like mental pleasure I wanted from partners. And then I was quite interested in just like hanging out with children, sort of in educational settings. So I worked for an education charity. And then what I really kind of my most, I guess, proud work in those educational settings were like, you know, the 1 week a year where you talk about like pride and LGBTQ identities, it's sort of like allocated.
I honestly don't think I even got that in school. Maybe more so now.
No, exactly. So maybe like 4 years ago, when I worked for this education charity, we did like, you know, what do different families look like? What are the kind of power dynamics in society that dictate whether someone can be, you know, open about their kind of family and relationships? And then I thought, actually, maybe this is the work that I want to do, not just 1 week of the year, but every day. And then someone asked me the question, you know, if you could make up your own job and role in society, what would it be? And I think we don't really ask ourselves that question enough. Like, we kind of limit our imaginations to, like, what we think already exists in the system. And I was like, if I could make it up, I would like talk to young people about sex and relationships in a really kind of sex positive, like queer inclusive way that really centers like what they want and what they want to know. And then, you know, I honestly, I feel so sort of lucky and privileged that this person was like, oh, well, actually, I know a person called Amelia Jenkinson, who is the founder and co-director of the School of Sexuality Education, formerly Sexplain. So then I
what a serendipitous thing.
I know, right?
I love that.
Yeah, reached out and now we're here. So I work for the School of Sexuality Education, and we go into schools, universities, community groups to talk about all things sex and relationships, from an intersectional, non-binary, sex-positive, and decolonizing perspective.
Yeah, and we love School of Sex Ed here on this podcast. I think I've interviewed a lot of you now. But it's just such great work that you do. And you mentioned from a decolonizing perspective, and you also do some work with decolonizing contraception.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So Decolonizing Contraception, founded by Dr. Annabel Choemimo, is a collective of Black people and people of color that work in all different disciplines around sexual and reproductive health. So we have doctors, nurses, mental health workers, researchers, and sex educators like myself, to really interrogate kind of how do we know what we know about health and healthcare, sort of challenging dominant narratives around kind of, you know, what is quote unquote normal in terms of, let's say, sex and relationships. And also, like, how are people treated within healthcare systems? Who gets, you know, the kind of, who gets listened to when they're trying to advocate for themselves? Whose pain is listened to more readily? We run workshops on decolonizing beauty standards, decolonizing sex education, even, you know, like, there's lots of policing that goes on in schools and in professional spaces around, like, how you should talk, how you should dress. And all of that is kind of white dominated, right? Like, the closer you are to whiteness, the more kind of acceptable you become. Challenging all of that.
When you say decolonizing sex education, I'd love to hear more about what is involved in that. Because, like you said, like, how do we know what we know? And, like, we can teach young people, like, here's different contraceptive methods, like, this is what healthy relationships looks like, or, you know, like, give them the information. But when you look at the history of how we often got that information, it's really white dominated and it's really oppressive. In terms of, like, what you think and in decolonizing sex ed and having intersectional sex ed, is there a place for that, like, going into, like, the history? Like, you have a class on contraception, but then you also go, here's why we know this and we need to be aware of the history of this too.
So I think it is best when it's integrated, right? So rather than having a separate kind of decolonizing session, that hopefully, you know, if we're imagining into the future, that all work and all teaching would be done through a decolonial lens. Like, teaching about contraception, you know, these are your options. You know, these are the times after school or after work where you can go and get them for free. But also, you know, why do we have this knowledge about contraception in the first place? Like, how has it been procured? And the reason why we need to know about the kind of colonial history of contraception and healthcare in general is so that we don't replicate the past. But even now, you know, lots of Black and brown people aren't getting the healthcare that they should receive because there is so much, and I don't like this term unconscious bias, because really, let's call it what it is. It's racism and prejudice. And I think it sort of, I would argue, a product of white fragility and whiteness trying to protect itself when we talk about unconscious bias. Because really, if you invested the time to, like, challenge how you behaved with, you know, different people, then you can sort of, you know, just, like, reflect and think, oh, I'm not treating, you know, XYZ people, you know, oppressed, marginalized people, whatever their intersecting identities were, in a sort of equitable and compassionate way.
Dig a little deeper and you can find the roots of that, and suddenly like it becomes conscious. But I guess like calling it unconscious bias means that you can be like, it's not my fault. I didn't know.
Yeah. And actually it's like, okay, cool. Well, if we don't know, how do we learn? And it is, you know, our sort of collective and also individual responsibility to seek out resources. I mean, you know, especially kind of with last year, there's so many podcasts, blogs, stuff on TV for all ages to learn. And actually, maybe I'll give it to you at the end, but I've just got sort of 10 different resources that I think are like exceptional. I go back to them every month. Yeah, and it's a kind of an array of like what you can listen to, watch, read. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, please share them and we can leave them in the show notes for people to check out as well. I'd love to also ask you about, because you mentioned how one of your focuses is making these sex ed spaces queer inclusive as well. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on the idea of decolonizing queerness, because that's also something that I remember having to unlearn at some point, maybe when I was at university. Like the general narrative that I was given, like as a child and as a teenager, was that like here in the UK, we're so accepting and like it's not illegal to be gay here anymore. But look at these other countries where they're so backwards. And then it was at university that I was like, hang on, but we gave them those laws. That was us. That's not them. I'd love to hear if that's something that you're trying to incorporate into sex ed as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So Alok Vedmenon, who's one of my kind of, absolute teachers, you know. I don't know them personally. I wish.
I follow them on Instagram.
Yeah. And their website, they kind of post, you know, thoughts and articles and poems. And they really kind of explore the creation of cisness as a sort of universal project of dominance. It's not like the biological template. It's very much constructed by kind of colonial white supremacists in order to control, right? So let's say 1800s, European colonialists arrive in, let's say, Sri Lanka, because that's where my family are from. So I'll just use my own kind of heritage as an example. You know, being sort of gender fluid, they wouldn't have called it that because they would have had their own language. But being gender fluid was kind of usual in society. It was expected. But then sort of colonizers came in, thought, oh, actually, the best way that we can conquer and dominate is to categorize these people. So then you have the creation of racial categories and gender categories, so the binary. So you can split people up, right, and say, okay, this is your job to do X, Y, Z, because you seem to fit what we call male or female or brown or black. And so it's not kind of the origin of who, you know, I now know my community to be. And actually that's really validating for me, because I'm like, you know, even though there's a lot of like queer phobia in my Tamil community that I witness, I mean, I think this is changing, which is great, and I'll get onto that. But although there is a lot of Tamil queer phobia, I'm like, actually, we can unlearn this, and it was created, and it's not actually kind of within our heritage. I mean, I can point to something in the past and be like, oh, that's me. Like, my way of being exists and existed back then.
And it existed with your Tamilness as well. Like, those two things go together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think kind of to to understand that, you know, sexism, queerphobia, anti-blackness, toxic masculinity, these are all consequences of like white colonial patriarchy, right? Like mm-hmm. you can create these categories of like, this is how you need to be. If you're not, then we can, you know, get rid of you. You're like excommunicated from society. Then you force people to conform, right?
Yeah.
So sexism comes from the binary, queerphobia comes from like not conforming to that binary, anti-blackness comes from like not being able to assimilate into whiteness, toxic masculinity comes from not kind of shaping yourself into kind of that quote unquote kind of ideal masculine like patriarch, but really mm-hmm. that doesn't exist in reality. Like none of that none of those templates actually exist in reality.
No, they're all made up.
Yeah.
It can be quite, I guess, liberating when you realize that as well. I'm just like, hang on, let's unpack this, because a lot of the arguments for keeping those binary and oppressive structures in place is that it's nature. Like, and then when you realize it's not, you're like, hang on.
Exactly.
I can be anything. Yeah.
Yeah. And just like, honestly, like one thing I've loved doing over the past year is just like reading, like watching the joy of like resistance. And you know, we can talk about kind of the struggle and you know, the intersectionality of struggle and kind of how we be better allies by like understanding that we have a common oppressor, and you know, that's important. But actually, like centering our joy is so radical, and it's like what the oppressor doesn't want us to do, right? Just existing and being kind of happy and excited. Actually, I'll just mention Inclusive Tamil Arts now.
Please tell us about it.
Yeah, I think it sort of fits in. So last year was in a Zoom workshop, actually one of the first Zoom workshops that I was in, sort of in March. I remember Googling that day, like, how do you operate Zoom? it was by Anbu UK, who are a Tamil-led charity that work with survivors of childhood sexual abuse. And that particular workshop was on queer Tamil histories and kind of finding the joy in and that recognition in like temples and artworks where there is like queer Tamilness to be seen, it's visible. And honestly, for the first time in my life, I met... other queer Tamil people who were kind of speaking openly and wanting to celebrate. And I was like, wow, like I never knew until that moment that I would find joy in this space. Like I didn't even seek it out before, you know?
Because you're like, just under the impression that it has to always be a struggle.
Right, exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or that, you know, oh, I've got my queer white friends over here, and I've got my like Tamil family over there, but those things don't kind of mix. And then kind of thinking, oh wow, this kind of intersectional space where my Tamilness and my queerness are definitely kind of embraced together and they kind of impact one another, this is really validating. So then with the kind of help of Anbu UK and the School of Sexuality Education and Decolonizing Contraception have been really supportive as well. We started up Inclusive Tamil Arts. So that is an organization to celebrate and create artwork that kind of imagines what a queer Tamil future could look like.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Honestly, it was just kind of a seed that was planted in my head in March of last year, and now we've got funding from the Arts Council, so that's lovely.
Amazing.
And yeah, we're going to be starting workshops at the end of January. The first one is on like creating art beyond gender, and yeah, it'll include some free writing exercises and kind of platforming queer Tamil artists who might not have got platforms that really centers who they are, you know?
Yeah, I really love that you mentioned imagining as well, because that came up in a previous podcast interview that I did where, it's just been coming up a lot for me about how we've been just like given these societal scripts around gender, sexuality, race, like all of these different things. And imagination as well as joy are these really powerful things at our disposal that, and it is about, yeah, like you said, like imagining these worlds, because we have to be able to imagine them in order to kind of create them.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, someone I'm reading right now, so Adrienne Marie Brown.
I have her book ordered and I'm like, I want to read it.
Honestly, like I feel like reading, so I'm reading Pleasure Activism at the moment, and even just picking it up and like, you know, writing my own notes in there and highlighting things, like I really feel like I'm in this joyful conversation with them. And one of the I can't remember the person who Adrienne's quoted, but it's the role of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible. And I feel like art has such a role to play, because we all, you know, have creativity inside of us, even if, you know, we might not call ourselves artists, you know, whether it's like journaling, doodling, just like playing, you know, like as children we play a lot and that's really joyful. I've actually been saying this year that like for my 30th I would love, and this is a tangent, but
we love tangents,
to have like a massive game of Stuck in the Mud.
Yes.
Right.
This is something that's also come up for me loads about play and like adults playing and like, and how that connects to like pleasure and sexuality as well. Like, I just think it's so huge that we often like get nervous and anxious about things like sex because we think of it as a place where we have to perform rather than a place where we get to play.
Yeah.
And I love that. I want to have like a big wacky warehouse, bouncy castle, 30th. That would be great.
Yes. No, exactly. Like, can I come? Like, that sounds...
Yeah, you're invited. I'm turning 30 next year, so hopefully we won't be in a pandemic.
Yeah, like, that's it, exactly. I think we get so nervous about, like, performing what is right. And, you know, I know you've spoken before about, like, oh, quote-unquote, being good in bed. But really it's like, well, how are we communicating with our partners? How are we like allowing all people involved to like ask for what they want, experiment, try things out, you know, consensually. Try it out. If you didn't like it, like, cool, okay, actually let's stop, let's try something else. And yeah, like that extends to like play Stuck in the Mud. Like let's free write. It doesn't need to be, you know, like officially a poem with, you know, this number of lines and rhyme schemes or whatever. I just think there's also like a lot to be said about whose art or like whose, again, knowledge is deemed like, you know, correct. Or if it comes out of an institution, then, you know, it's valid or, you know, it's certificated or whatever.
Or whose art gets celebrated.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, who gets to tell their own story, you know? Recently, I've been having conversations about, like, as an artist, like, should you be telling someone else's story where, like, you have privilege and power to tell that story of like the person who is oppressed rather than like them having their own platform to be able to like speak. I mean, going back to kind of how this ties into like education and like sex relationships education, like
it's all so connected.
Because in the classroom, like who you know takes up the most space, like who gets to challenge dominant knowledge without like consequences. Do you know what I mean? And just like allowing students like to say, oh, that doesn't make sense, that like we should just accept what you're saying without ever like challenging authority or you know, like why do we have to write or speak in this way? You know, it extends to uniforms. Why is this kind of a monogamous relationship the thing that, you know, like has to fall into, you know, that kind of trajectory of marriage? And then there are lots of legal privileges with marriage, and that's all kind of around cisness and the validity of monogamous relationships. Like, I guess what for me the most important thing is, can we equip young people to challenge like what is quote unquote like the truth or what is right, and to question like power structures, because they're everywhere.
I think about like a toddler who's learning to speak and like seeing the world for the first time and is going, why this, like why that? And then it's not that we grow out of saying why, it's that we learn and we're taught to stop asking questions. And if, you know, in the case of a sex ed classroom, you've got the like, but why does it have to be marriage? Like, why does why do relationships have to be monogamous? Like, why do cis women have to dress a certain way? Or like, why do I have to adhere to the gender binary? Like, but we often just kind of like tell young people like, because I told you so, without kind of going, oh, actually why? Let's like, and then like from that next level, like why again? And then why again? But yeah, you're so right. We need to be equipping young people with like, but also like, with the ability and the tools to challenge things, but then also like the permission, because often it's just like, oh, we just stop asking questions after a while, and we just have to accept that that's the way the world is.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially with like binary sex ideas, which are like, I think maybe we're moving to this point where people are more happy to accept that there is a you know, infinite variation in gender, but that sort of they falsely believe that there are just two main sex characteristics, so like male and female. This is completely a myth. There is just as much variation in sex characteristics, so like chromosomes, hormones, genitals, and I think that needs to be challenged, you know, from the point of when a baby is delivered, you know, and a box is ticked about whether they're male and female, and you're sort of, it's so arbitrary because there's so much about that person that we don't know, and maybe that we'll never know. Really, I feel like moving towards, you know, in some countries they have sort of like a way to mark sort of intersex, but also even like going beyond that, like genitals can't be, you know, fixed in these boxes because there is just so much difference. Do you know what I mean?
This is something I've been thinking about so much as well, because often people, like you said, still kind of like hold on to the fact that you've got male and you've got female, like that's kind of like at least biology there is clear categories and truth, and it's like and the thing that I keep grappling and struggling with is how our language limits us in having these conversations and trying to understand these concepts, because the language that we have is like the main tool for understanding these things. And so that's when I always feel like I fall short in my understanding, because I can't put it to words. There's no words available for me. And I'm like, do we need new words? Like, do we just need to scrap male, female? Like, like what? But then like, I don't know what consequences that would cause. And then also it's just like, do we even need more categories? Because like a lot of the issues that we're having are from like like you said, like the white colonial patriarch, like categorizing everybody else. Mm. So I was just like, I've got no answers, only questions.
Yeah. No, you really just there, like, voiced a lot of my own thinking. It's really hard to sort of think about what future options could be. I guess, yeah, like the core sort of question I would always come back to is, like, how can we just let people be as they are? Mm. Right? So, like, if someone's like, cool, I identify as a girl and only a girl, then great. I identify as, you know, I relate to parts of boyhood and girlhood, or someone else is like, actually, those words don't mean anything to me. Then actually, mm-hmm, all of those people are obviously within their right to, like, identify in those ways. So, mm-hmm, so maybe rather than saying, you know, what new language should we create, it's actually like, well, let's just, like, you know, allow and encourage people to, like, use whatever words or no words that they want.
Play with it. Play.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
Because, yeah, mold it. Mold it to fit how you feel.
Yeah, exactly. I guess, like, play with it, find what might work for you, and, like, the point that we want to be at is that no one, like, questions or, like, challenges you about your own identity, because it doesn't make, mm-hmm, any sense for someone to be like, oh, I know better than you about who you are, right? That is, in a sentence, like, the colonial problem. Like, people with power saying, I know better than you about who you are, about your culture, about, like, what your future is going to look like, and you're going to, kind of fit that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So true. I've got some questions from people on Instagram. This one I thought was really interesting. So this person has asked, what are your thoughts on modesty and queerness? And they've said how they hate how those two are treated as opposite in the West.
Oh, that's interesting. I would first maybe ask myself, like, what does modesty mean? Mm.
There's a spectrum of modesty.
Yeah, are we talking modesty, like...
In my head, I assume it to mean about dress.
Yeah.
That's kind of like how I always hear the word modesty kind of like being used, but...
Yeah.
I might be wrong.
It's interesting. Maybe we could have a whole question around, like, you know, what does modesty even mean?
Yeah.
is that word, like, moralizing over, like, you know, how we should behave, how we should dress, mm-hmm, is it like policing our bodies?
It's an interesting one, because that's so true. Like, most of the time when I hear the word modest and modesty, it's like the oppressor basically saying you should dress a certain way that is more modest. It's like coming from the outside. But then more recently, I feel like I've been stumbling across, like, mostly young women, I think, online or like on Instagram, where their, like, Instagram account is like about modest fashion, and it's something that they own, and they're like, that is like reclaimed as theirs and something that they identify with. And I just find it so fascinating.
Oh, right. Okay. I've not come across that. That's interesting. I'll look into it. But yeah, I guess to answer the question, I have not thought about it. I guess, like, there are as many different ways of being queer as there are people. Like, mm-hmm, those two things, I wouldn't say have any particular, like, correlation, like, high or low. Do you know what I mean? I think, yeah, I mean, personally, I don't think there is a sort of, it's not like they're opposites or kind of aligned. But, you know, one question that sometimes we get asked in lessons is, like, why, and if we're talking about modesty being sort of quiet and submissive, we're asked, like, oh, why, for example, during Pride or just in general, are queer people so, like, loud and flashy and like really
and scantily dressed.
Sorry, say that again.
And scantily dressed.
Right, yeah, like up in your face about their queerness. And, you know, we have sort of that conversation around, well, you know, why do we have pride? And, you know, maybe like it's been quite commercialized, but there's lots of like splashing rainbows around. But for me, there's like three reasons. So there's like joy and like uplifting the community. There's educating society, because there's still so much queerphobia and violence in the world still. And then also it's really, yeah, a chance to kind of advocate for, you know, different laws or policies. And I don't think that you would question, oh, why is someone celebrating, you know, a different kind of aspect of themselves? People are particularly, I don't know, critical of like queerness, but, you know, being like too loud or whatever. But again, that's another form of policing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Somebody asked, what has queerness among, and they've said Tamilians, and I don't know if that is what Tamil people are describing.
I get the question. Yeah. Yeah.
Tamilians. Cool. What has queerness among Tamilians looked like historically?
Yeah, really interesting. So there are lots of sort of historical stories around like fluid gender, fluid sexuality that you can find in Tamil history. Some of it is sort of religious and some of it's not. In like temples, you can see kind of erotic art of, you know, orgies and of oral sex. And it's not, you know, like tucked away in the darkness. It's, you know, kind of high up and in the center, and you can, you know, it's very visible. I think it was sort of unembarrassable. It was like proud. And so, you know, if you just, yeah, look out for them, they're there. And I think more and more, so like writers like Sean Salvadore, Akweke Amazi, who is half Nigerian, half Tamil, are sort of bringing these stories to the fore.
Love that. Love those. We always love book recommendations as well. Yeah. And then somebody asked, what are typical mistakes white sex educators make in terms of intersectionality or lack thereof?
So Professor Kimberly Crenshaw came up with this term to kind of show the multiple sources of oppression that might impact a person. She sort of reviewed this case initially. So in 1976, Emma de Graffenried was a black woman in the US, and she filed a suit against a car manufacturing plant because she wasn't hired, and she believed it was because she was black and a woman. So she filed for like race and gender discrimination. The case was thrown out of court, and it happened to several other black American women as well, because the company did hire women, so white women, and also men, black men. And so they were like, actually, they do hire women and black people, so you're basically wrong, right? Like, we're not going to listen to this.
Yeah.
What Kimberly Crenshaw highlighted is that actually what was missing here was a framework to recognize that the specific discrimination that was being faced here was against black women, right? But that we had no framework to understand that. So intersectionality is this framework within which we can understand people's overlapping identities and the struggles and marginalization that they will face because of them. And so I guess it's like, you know, trying to think of maybe students as individuals, all kind of communication that they do, kind of all their behavior is communicating something about their need or their want. And then I think, and maybe it's not, you know, it's not white educators that specifically are sort of missing this, I'd say. It's just maybe if someone isn't thinking about the intersectional struggle or oppressions that different people face, then you're going to end up, I think, unintentionally or unknowingly excluding or harming certain people. So if we're thinking about, and I always come back to kind of language or dress or tone, like all these things can be and are policed from like day one, from nursery. You know, I remember kind of getting in trouble because I had I was maybe at one point in my life actually more fluent in Tamil than I was in English, and just not having the English words for things, and then kind of, you know, being seen as like problematic because I just didn't know how to communicate properly. Well, quote unquote properly. And that I was sort of seen as maybe a bit of a nuisance. This is when I was really little. But anyway, I guess, yeah. So maybe in the classroom, kind of when, I guess when using examples, let's say in kind of sex and relational education, using a real kind of diverse range of examples, different types of relationships, thinking about like, what are we saying when we're always pointing to like marriage as like the epitome of, I don't know, life? That's kind of your goal, or even that like higher education would be the goal. You know, so many of these institutions are like built off of the like, you know, enslaved people and sort of immigrants that, you know, had no power or say in what they were kind of forced to do.
One language thing that I've been thinking a lot about recently as well is how easily we'll say things like, oh, when you have a partner or when you have sex or when you get married or when you go to uni. And actually we just need to scrap that and just say like, if, like it's such a simple switch, but it really says so much when we say when.
Yeah, definitely. And also think about like economic power and privilege or lack thereof. So, you know, thinking about, oh, does this person have access to like a computer at home? Are they sharing with like other family members? You know, if they weren't able to kind of complete work, why might this be? Maybe rather than jumping to like, oh, they, I don't know, couldn't be bothered or are just like willfully disrespecting me, quote unquote, like that's really centering like your own kind of wants rather than like thinking about, oh, what isn't happening for this person such that they can't show up to this space in like a way that is meaningful to them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I hope that answers the question. It's maybe not so much like white educators specifically, right?
Yeah.
Like I think all of us have a part to play in like upholding white supremacy. And, you know, as a South Asian, I will have certain privileges and like a proximity to whiteness where like perhaps some of my black colleagues don't, right? Like the kind of gatekeeping by kind of white power might allow me in a bit more, and rather than me being like, oh, I'll take the power that I can get, actually thinking, okay, how can I dismantle this kind of system that I somewhat benefit from, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, same with any sort of white educators, like how can I center, you know, black, indigenous and people of color and their experiences, you know, not speaking for kind of the people that you're talking about, but maybe like playing a video. Or yeah, just like reading out from the experience of, yeah, a person who identifies in that way, you know, whether you're talking about disability or queerness, or yeah, kind of people who are oppressed through like not having economic power, really centering their experiences. And if possible, like paying them, there's lots of opportunities to pay them for it, you know, like if they have a patron, like if you're going to use a video, say of a black sex educator, have they got a Patreon? Have they got a PayPal? Can you like pay for that content, you know?
Yeah. And even like in like the materials that you use as well, like if there's illustrations or cartoons of people in that, there's a few artists that I can like, if I remember them, I'll put them in the show notes, who create like diverse sex ed teaching materials. That all, because if you go onto Google and you're like searching for images and stuff to use as like sex ed materials, you will find a sea of whiteness. But yeah, there's, I think you're so right in the in terms of like the fighting against our own assumptions about what young people need, and really like seeing them as individuals and each like, and yeah, what each of them need, but then also like this practical side of things of like videos and teaching materials and like the language that you use, like there's like the thinking about it, and then there's also the like, okay, let's put this into practice.
And one more thing on that is like, you know, if say there's a white person who's asked to speak on something, but actually like maybe it's not your place to speak on that thing, or maybe you could question, okay, in this day of events or on this panel, is it all white people or is it majority white people? Why is that? Like using your power to question and actually like decline those requests and be like, actually, no, I don't think that I should be taking up this space because this is already a majority white space, or actually I'm not the person that should be speaking on this. How about, you know, blah, blah, have you tried asking this person, you know, and like actively like stepping down off your platform and like off, like, offering it to somebody else who maybe wouldn't be asked, you know, to do that work.
It's always good to have lots of names to be able to like recommend to people, like this, try this person instead.
Yes, exactly. So I think it's important to ask yourself questions like, and I ask myself these questions, how might I be upholding white fragility? How am I protecting myself within this kind of white supremacist framework? Am I a scaffold upon which whiteness, you know, is dominating this space? You know, am I just kind of the brown face as like a tick box exercise? And actually, am I going to like challenge that?
Those are all really great questions. Well, Gayathri, thank you so much. This has been such a great conversation. I've absolutely loved chatting with you. Where can people find you online, find Inclusive Tamil Arts?
Thank you so much for chatting. So I am at Unembarrassable on Instagram, and then Inclusive Tamil Arts is at Inclusive Tamil Arts. The School of Sexuality Education is at School Sex Ed. I'm just gonna double check that.
We can pop it all in the show notes as well.
Yeah, definitely. And Decolonizing Contraception is at Decolonizing Contraception. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And thank you all for listening. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to Doing It. If you enjoyed it, I would really appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can find show notes at doingitpodcast.co.uk, and do go follow us on social media, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye. This was a Global Original podcast.